Welcome back to Out of the Main, a Yacht Rock podcast. Put a pin in that or put an asterisk next to it. But I can't decide, John, if this is my biggest dream or worst nightmare, because the worst nightmare part is I'm a bass player sandwiched between two technically proficient drummers.
Yeah, drummer day. It's like Doobie Brothers, dual drummers.
And I'm clearly out of my league as the bass player, so I won't even try to play along. But that won't stop me from talking to our guest today, so I think I can pull that off.
Okay.
So we are really honored, excited to welcome in Trissom Bowden. Triss, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you guys.
Yep, calling in from sunny San Diego, soon to be relocated to the beaches of Florida. Is that right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, about 6 months from now, if all goes according to plan. We hope to keep a place here as well, because we have family here and all. But yeah, we're going to be Floridians.
Cool. Well, before we dive into your career, I was explaining to you before we kind of went on air that I think our range of listeners ranges from the hardcore yacht rock zealots who knew every piece of personnel on any piece of yacht rock ever recorded. And then at the other end of the spectrum, some people who are just learning what yacht rock even is. They just know that they love just music even related to yacht rock, you know, light rock from the late 70s, early 80s. They don't know any of the players. So tell us, how would you explain to that audience who Trissom Bowden is relative to yacht rock?
Well, as a result of my involvement, I think with, at the time we were doing music that has now been deemed yacht rock, we had no idea there would be such a thing.
Yeah.
But I was, with my association with Kenny Loggins, my long association with him, and my good fortune of playing on all those hit records, his biggest records, and particularly those collaborations with Michael McDonald and he, with such songs as This Is It and Heart to Heart and, you know, those ones. Apparently, they are considered essential yacht rock now.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And I'm very proud of those records, I have to say. As a result of those records, I also was starting to get called to perform with other acts on their recordings too. So I recorded with Gary Wright on his last hit, a song called I Really Want to Know You in the early 80s, and a band called Firefall.
Yeah.
That I joined that band actually when Kenny went on hiatus to start a family year off. So George Hawkins, the bass player from the Kenny Loggins band, and I were asked to join Firefall. Firefall had been opening for us on tour, and their bass player, Mark Andes, had left and joined Heart, and Mike Clark had left, the drummer, who was formerly with the Birds and the Burrito Brothers and that. So anyway, we did a, we had one hit off that album. It was, the album was called Clouds Across the Sun, and I think there was sort of a minor hit called Staying With It.
I'm staying with it, letting my heart take me there. Got a feeling, ooh, I'm going somewhere. Deep in it.
Yeah, I've got the vinyl right here. I got your picture in here, too. I can see what you looked like back then.
Amazing. Wow, you guys have really done your homework.
So what year is that? That's late 70s. I know I had hair. Did Triss have hair back then?
Yeah. That had to be about 82 or so, I think.
Cool. Well, we did talk to Mark and Jock about, I think it was December of last year.
Yeah.
So they were really cool.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, well, I love Mark. I love both those guys so much. And unfortunately, I don't get to see him that often. You know, when Chicago would blow through Colorado, you know, Jock had come to a show at Red Rocks or whatever. But I haven't seen Mark in years. And we ended up recording together later with Jay Ferguson, you know, his old band compatriot from Spirit. And did a solo album, a real fun album called White Noise. Appropriately named.
Well, and you mentioned Chicago. So the last bit of context I think that anyone would need is you were a longtime drummer with Chicago since starting in 91. Is that right?
Actually, 1990 to 2018. My last gig with them was, I believe, March of 2018. Yeah.
All right, John. So you're the other drummer.
Yeah, I want to go all the way back before all of that and ask you really quickly. According to your Wikipedia page, which we know that's where all the truth is.
Yeah, right.
Obviously, you play multiple instruments. You're credited as vocals on some stuff, harmonica on some stuff. We know you played trumpet. Obviously, drums became the big one. But it also mentioned that you're self-taught in that. Is that true? And if so, what was your process for learning? Who did you emulate? How did you go about self-teaching?
Wow, that's a great question. I am self-taught to a point in that I learned how to read in junior high school band. And I actually started playing trumpet first there because there was no room in the drum section. But I was buddies with all the drummers and hung out with them. And yeah. The band director knew I was really a drummer at heart. So when there was an opening, he let me slide in there. But he was not a drum instructor per se.
Right.
And I never had any formal drum instruction until I sought it out much later in my 20s, actually. You know, what I was talking about was when I was like 12 or 11 or so in the junior high school, I guess 12 or 13.
Right.
Yeah. I emulated everybody I would hear on record. My folks were big band nuts, so I, of course, was way into Gene Krupa and that solo on Sing, Sing, Sing.
Yep.
And with Benny Goodman. Buddy and then Joe Morello, they love jazz as well. So Joe was a big influence, and Elvin and all those guys I was listening to, although I couldn't figure out how the hell to do that stuff.
I know,
but it was in there anyway, so I took it upon myself in my 20s to start studying at West Coast Drum Shop in Orange County here in California. And I was in a band that was actually, you know, making some waves and had a record deal in that and opening for Loggins and Messina, which proved prophetic.
Yeah, very.
Opening for Chicago, too.
Wow.
Now, we went on the road with the Beach Boys and that. That was a band called Honk. But back to your question, I started honing my reading skills and maybe a little hand technique, although not much. My teacher didn't say, hey, man, your grip sucks or anything like that. So over the years, as a result of my bad technique, I've had carpal tunnel since like the late 70s. And so, you know, in fact, it got so bad for a while that I'd have to, in the middle of a drum solo, look at my hands because they were numb, you know, to make sure I was holding on to the sticks. So anyway, I've tried to address that now, you know, throughout my career when I started really taking it seriously, you know, and developing some hand technique. I'm still like Fred Flintstone, though, man. I'm playing.
Her animal from the Muppets,
you know. Yeah, yeah. Mongo light drum.
Yes.
Well, what's interesting about that, John, I was just going to bring up, and maybe you were going to as well, but I'll steal your thunder. So great. John here is a drummer, self-taught, and he taught himself by emulating two drummers that I'm sure you'll be familiar with. One was Jeff Porcaro.
Yeah.
Oh, my good friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And John, who was the other one?
Well, when I got more mature later on, so it was early on, it was some other guys. It was like, the guy from Boston, whoever it was that played that. I know Sib was credited and all that. But one of the other guys that I really emulated was, of course, Danny Serafine.
Uh-huh.
So we'll get to that question. You are stealing my thunder a little bit, but that the Chicago thing is really, really interesting to me. But first you did the Loggins thing, and I noticed when I was going back, I thought you played on all the early Loggins stuff, and then I noticed that actually Celebrate Me Home was Steve Gadd and Harvey Mason.
Right.
So then from there, you get the gig for the next several records. How did you get that call? How did that happen? And it seems like both for this case and Chicago, you became a band member as opposed to just a session guy for hire, because you went on tour with these guys as well, right?
Yeah, I did. And actually, how that happened was Kenny was looking to put a band together. He had George Hawkins, the bass player that played on Celebrate Me Home, but also had done the last tour with Loggins and Messina, the farewell tour. The two horn players were there as well, John Clark and Vince Denham, absolute brilliant horn players, genius, both of them, and as was George. And anyway, I was working with a British artist that I'd done a couple of albums with, me, named Ian Matthews, and we were getting ready to go on the road, opening for Little Feet, and I was all excited about that. Then I heard about these auditions for this Kenny Loggins tour, and that he had a new album out, and that the album was incredible. So I thought, what the hell, just go and audition, thinking I had a deer fart in a windstorm's gig, because it was no less than 150 drummers that were auditioning, and most of which were my heroes, or some of which, anyway. So, yeah. But anyway, I heard this music, and they had charts as well. And the way the auditions went were they'd play one of the songs for you, you'd read it down, and then they'd play it again for you. And then so for those who didn't read well, hopefully you could commit to memory. Right. Well, that album was so hip, man, Celebrate Me Home, and Steve Gadd being one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah.
And Harvey Mason, one of my all-time favorites, and both of which had become two of my major influences. I was in heaven, because there it was, like written out as well. I mean, exactly what Gadd played, you know.
Wow.
And I've got the music, And what's the name of the song? I Believe in Love. Anyway, it just went so well, and George and I just connected. It was just one of those things, you know, a feel thing, you know, where we just kind of felt everything in the same spot.
Did they know you could sing too? Did that kind of help?
Yeah, although I didn't really audition as a vocalist, okay. but they found out after the fact that I was a singer. And that's a funny story. I'll tell you why I'm not singing anymore, or part of the reason. Loggins told me he didn't like the way singing drummers looked. And so I went, really? And he said, yeah. So I got like real self-conscious about it. And I
that's funny. So did you point out Phil Collins? Don Henley?
No, at the time I was defenseless. I was
I'm sure. You know,
I might throw in Mickey Dolenz.
So anyway, so I just kind of went, screw it, I'll just, you know, focus on the drums. And you know, like anything, it's a muscle, use it or lose it. And so I lost it, but I keep saying if I can ever cough that fur ball up, I'll start singing again.
There you go. Yep. So it sounded like those early albums were like record the band, you know, in the studio, get the whole band, get a whole take, and then maybe overdub some vocals and solos and stuff. But they didn't seem like they were pieced together track by track, you know. And then, later on, the Loggins stuff took on such a production value that, you know, you had songs that were so like edited and produced like... you know, like Footloose and the Vox Humana years and things like that. So how did your role and your involvement, you know, talk about that as it pertained to a drummer, changing over from band recording to more layer by layer kind of?
Kenny has always been very hands-on and meticulous about every little corner. He really likes to make sure everything's polished and has been looked at. And as a result, we had the luxury of rehearsing most all those songs on like night watch before we went to New York to record them. And my favorite recording that I did with him actually was the entire Keep the Fire album. I absolutely love that. And This Is It was the only song that we really hadn't rehearsed much, ironically. This is it.
You're back to the girl now.
that came together in the studio because he and Michael had written it later. But I loved the process when it was the whole band and the whole band tracking too, or at least the rhythm section. You know, George Hawkins was always just so incredibly musical. I mean, he would come up with these like lines that melodically and harmonically were so hip and complemented the song, but also rhythmically so cool. And section to section, you know, they'd change. Mm-hmm. And he and I would collaborate on that, you know, to try to support the song always first and the vocalist, but could kind of stand up on their own and be interesting. So
yeah, I saw some arranging credit for you on a couple of those, I think, in the liners.
Well, I just loved doing that with George. And later with Nathan East, too, you know, when Nate started playing with Kenny. But at that point, when Nathan had joined the band, it had become more of that, like you're talking about, less cutting with the rhythm section live and more layering, you know. If we had the benefit of rehearsing a song before we went in, then we would do what I was just saying, you know, more of that approach, you know, really composing the rhythm track. You
know? And I've always been really interested in the drum track to I'm All Right, the theme from Caddyshack, because it's so different. And the first time, you know, I'm 50 years old, so the first time that song comes out, all I can have the capacity to do is just enjoy the song, right? The melody. Uh-huh. And then I start getting into yacht rock. What I now discover is yacht rock about 5-10 years ago. I have a quasi career as a musician behind me, not that good of one, but so I at least can now listen for new things. And that was one of the first things in yacht rock that I'm like, that drum track is killer. Yeah, John's pantomiming it, but maybe we could play a little of it so people know what I'm talking about. So my question to you then is on where does that fall? Was that your concoction? Was that, hey, Kenny told you I want this? Or was it just something that evolved naturally in the session when you were recording?
Well, no, it actually, that did, I believe that was more an evolution during the session. That evolved during the session, rather. We'd been on the road opening for Fleetwood Mac, and I'm sorry, I'm jumping all over the place, but that Celebrate Me Home album, we had the privilege of opening for Fleetwood Mac because everybody wanted to during the Rumors tour, right? So as a result, Kenny really got into and loved, as we all do, that John McVie McFleetwood thing, you know, with the big ones and threes on the, you know, on the bass drum, and, you know, toms is part of the pattern and that, you know, so he was looking for something like that. And George and I just kind of, that was sort of our interpretation of that sort of thing. I really, you know, I heard that song the other day and I went, God, that's a hip record.
It is. It sounded, nothing else sounded like it at the time. That's for sure.
I also love so much that a cappella vocal breakdown in the bridge, you know, where he kind of goes to Beach Boys land.
All right, my other quick question. Sorry, John. Who did the doom, doom, doom? I mean, I got the guy on the line right now. I got to ask the questions when I can ask him.
That's all right. Do it.
So who does doom, doom, doom?
Well, live, I forget who did that. It wasn't me. But live, I did, on the record, it's Eddie Money's. No, Cannonball right away. That's
where Eddie is. Okay, I couldn't place it.
On the live version, it was me.
Oh, nice. You got to be Eddie Money, too.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing was they released the live version as a single. And so, I became a member of AFTRA. I was a singer, all of us.
Suddenly the royalties are pouring in, right?
Because my voice was more gruff and sounded more like Eddie Money than anybody else is in the band. So I covered that part.
All right. So we're now, Tom, we're asking those kind of get in the weeds sort of questions.
Get us out of it.
I got one my own. First of all, I have to mention that my particular favorite is the High Adventure album. I thought you played some killer stuff on that. We even mentioned that at the beginning of I Gotta Try.
Oh!
But the beginning of I Gotta Try, where you're laying that groove down, and then Abe Laboriel, I believe, is the bass player on doing those slides. We've used that part in the show. I love that. But the question I had to have is, so now you're into we're getting into the later years. We're getting into Vox Humana, and suddenly there's these things called drum machines and Simmons drums. And a regular, drummer coming out of the 70s, I would love to know what your thoughts were having to play that. And I particularly love the big, huge Simmons fill at the end of Forever. Love that.
The beginning, too.
Yeah. That's right. It leads you in.
Yeah. Well, that was, David Foster and Kenny had written that tune together. And David was always known for his enormous drum sounds, courtesy of Humberto Gatica and the AMS, right? That little gadget that just beefed everything up so much. I, during that period, had embraced Simmons and was everybody had, I loved the fact that, that tom sound, I mean, it's like, the tom that ate New York or something.
You're announcing yourself with that, that's for sure.
Big like sky, dumb like us, and Humberto really knew how to maximize those sounds too, In fact, he took my Simmons brain, my head, he wouldn't let me touch it. He had it on the top of his console, and we took an hour and a half to dial in.
To program it,
the beefiest sounds possible on the tom-toms for both Forever and No Looking Back, I think. For Footloose. And, but that's a funny story about Footloose. I don't want to jump all over the place here.
Let's hear the Footloose.
I've told this story a million times, but.
Gotta hear it.
May have not heard this. Footloose, actually, Kenny being the rehearsal nut that he is, and as I said before, likes to look at every little piece that's going into a recording ahead of time, if possible, and really take aim. We'd been on the road for a few months knowing that we were going to be recording this song, Footloose. Now, Kenny's renowned for making sound checks into rehearsals. I mean, like hours long. And he still does it to this day, I can attest, because I went back and played with him again after leaving Chicago. He's still doing it.
Wow.
But anyway, so we had been going through this song over and over and over and over. I mean, at sound checks for months on the road. And Nathan East and I, Buzzy Featon and Neil Larson, Steve Wood, when we got home off the road, we went into the record plant in LA and we cut that song in two takes. The first one was for sound and the second one was it. I mean, we had just lifted our legs collectively and peed on it because we knew it inside and out,
Yeah.
And the irony is, and this is a true story, I was walking out of the studio arm in arm with Nathan East, and we were looking at each other going, that's the last time we'll ever have to hear that piece of crap.
Yeah, whatever happened to that song?
Oh, no, it isn't.
I mean, it blew up, of course.
Playing it for the rest of your life.
Exactly, and now I got to admit, I love it. I just got a 9x platinum, record.
Purely iconic 80s song. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And it sounds a whole lot better to me on the air than
I bet.
But
there was a lot of post production done on that track, I'm sure.
Well, there was. I cut now. More to your point, I cut the basic track with acoustic drums, and then the drum breakdown, I went in and just overdubbed it, what I was playing on the acoustic drums, and mm-hmm. kept okay. the original kick pattern, you know. But that's me on acoustic and Simmons, you know. So got a pretty juicy, big sound on that record as well. But man, Forever and there was a number of them. And also with other artists, with David Foster, I did the love theme from St. Elmo's Fire, which was a hit. I did a lot of Simmons overdubs for records he was producing. A few for actually Neil Diamond.
Yeah, Headed for the Future. That's a favorite of mine. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And then there's another album, The Best Years of My Life, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I was getting a lot of work as a Simmons striker.
Yeah, I get it.
I was going to ask both of you actually what the mindset of a drummer is around 1985 when you can see this technology coming. I always call it the rise of the machines that happen, and you're getting paid to sit behind a kit. And like I know John, he embraced all the digital wave, and I love the drum machines.
And it
sounds like you
stuff.
Did too. So how did most people do you think in the day, or did they resist it? And how did your role change as a recording artist?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, originally, I resisted there at first drum machines because I was a firm believer in human time. And in fact, that's why guys like Jeff Beccaro, Steve Gadd, you know, Harvey Mason, you know, Mike Baird, Carlos Vega, J.R. Robinson, and myself, if I can include myself, were being hired was because of our ability to generate time that felt good.
And feel.
Felt like
right.
With feel, you know. Right. And the thing about drum machines that I didn't like was just how stiff and regimented they were.
Yeah.
Although there were guys that were so adept at programming like Pat Mastellotto and guys like that, that they could make it feel like it was a real drummer. It just blew my mind. I was never that guy. I didn't embrace it once I was forced to to really learn how to do that. But man, you know, that was a big reason why we all got the work we did was because of our feel. And so that's why I kind of resisted it. But when it came to sonics and sound and that, I mean, I loved all the electronics, you know what I mean? Like Simmons.
Those early Simmons, though, pads, that's where your carpal tunnel started, I can tell you that. Those were like hitting coffee tables. Those things were so hard.
They sure were. And then they tried to dignify them or soften the blow a little bit.
You did that tennis elbow going, oh man.
Yeah, man. That's true.
Well, maybe there's a good spot to take a break. We can rest our carpal tunnel, rest our voices. We did end up speaking, as we often do with guests, with Tris for about an hour. So we thought we would break this up again into two episodes. We're thinking, just quickly, John, you and I have talked about, would people rather sit through an hour plus podcast or have 2 30-minute, and obviously we've thought that it's probably better on people's schedule and attention spans to break it up into two. But if people have strong feelings either way, let us know on Facebook, send us a note. But unless we hear otherwise, this is what we'll do with the longer episodes to try to keep everything around 35, 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's a good time length for like a car ride, riding to work or from work, or, you know, train ride, however people come and go. But I wanted to go back. You touched on something there when we were talking to Tris, specifically when we were talking about I'm All Right, the Caddyshack tune. And you had to ask him about who did the do-do-do, who's the this guy, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, funny thing was, the very next day, I happened to be listening to, I just bought a nice vinyl reissue of ABBA's Super Trooper. And I know it doesn't seem like it relates. Well, it's a great sounding release. It was remastered at Abbey Road. They cut it into two discs, so two 45 RPM discs. It just sounds amazing. But anyway, so I have this blasting in the living room, and the chorus comes on to Super Trooper. And then I find myself singing along with the low guy, Super Trooper, and, you know, strutting around the house, Super Trooper.
I wish I could have seen that.
Well, and that reminded me of you asking about the low voice.
Doop, doop.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of other kind of similar things started rushing into my head. I started thinking about the Beach Boys did a song called Vegetables.
I jumped up and down and hoped it tossed me a carrot. I'm gonna keep well.
We were just watching the McCartney documentary with Rick Rubin on Hulu, and he hit him with McCartney's version of Check My Machine. So on Vegetables, you had Paul McCartney is actually one of the people chomping on vegetables in the microphone to create the rhythm track. And then, of course, you got this bizarre voice that McCartney's doing on Check My Machine. And there's probably a whole bunch of others. And I'm thinking to myself, self, what must it have been like? Here they are standing in front of the microphone doing something that in that very moment had to seem really stupid,
right?
Whether it's the doo-doo or Super Trooper or chewing on a carrot or any of these things. I'm like, it had to seem so dumb at the time, yet they had the, I guess, artistic courage or the I don't care or whatever it is to see it through, regardless of how dumb they felt. And now here we are 30, 40, even 50 years later, hearing those things and going, man, that part's so cool. Super.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the psychology of that just really interests me.
Well, two things. One is put a pin in that, because that's going to come up in the lightning round here in just a minute. And then the other thing is, I just watched last night Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time. Have you seen it?
There you go. Another good example.
So they do a whole thing, and I don't know how much of it is fictionalized, but I'm sure it's close to the truth when they're trying to nail the operatic harmonies in Bohemian Rhapsody, the song. Just what a stickler Freddie Mercury was for the drummer hitting that high part.
Yep, and you could even probably go back to the whole Peg thing with Michael McDonald, how dumb he felt singing that, yet it's considered iconic now. You know,
yep, absolutely.
Where would we be if these artists were so playing it safe?
Right.
Right.
Well, there's another little like montage scene in Bohemian Rhapsody where they're recording their first record, I think, even before they got discovered. And they're doing all sorts of gimmickry. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
You know, they got coins rolling around and they're hitting buckets. And, you know, according to the movie, that's right when the guy from EMI walked into the studio and says, "Who are these guys? These guys are crazy. And I want to sign them." Right. So.
Right. Right.
Yep. You're right. It's a good observation.
You know what else is really, really stupid, but we've rolled with it, is the lightning round sound effect.
Well, let's hit it. I'm going to let you go first in this lightning round. Mine has nothing to do with the Tris and Bowden episode that we're recording and cutting into two parts, but I'm going to do something a little different with the lightning round this time. And so I want you to go first, because mine naturally segues right into buried treasures. So what do you got?
Okay. Then I'm going to start with one that I've been holding for a while. It's not related at all to Tris, but I've been holding onto this one for the Float Your Boat segment, because I find this song to be confusing, I guess, as to how it relates to Yacht Rock, but I see it posted every now and again. Your thoughts on Alan Parsons' project, Eye in the Sky.
I am sky, looking at you, I can read your mind. I am the maker of rules, dealing
My personal thoughts?
Yeah, your personal thoughts.
And you're not asking, I mean, just so I know, this is our podcast, so I should kind of know the rules, but you're not asking, should it be considered yachty? You're just, does it float my boat? Do I consider it yachty at all, right?
Yeah, I will tell you that the guys that did the Yachtsky scale were quite, there's a lot of variation. There's a 42 score, there's a 51 score, there's a 54, and there's a 28. So,
Who hit him with the 28?
That was Dave, who I guess is not working with them anymore, from what I understand. So maybe that was why. I don't know.
Yeah.
He got fired, right? In the sky. What are you doing? Come on.
Right. I'm with whoever went 44.
42.
I don't think it, 42. I don't think it quite makes the boat. I do have it in my playlist, but again, my playlist isn't strict yacht rock. So I would say, no, not really, but I do like the tune enough that I want to hear it. And, it's got part of the unsanctioned yacht rock quality. By unsanctioned, I mean the people who just think of light rock as, you know, the nostalgia factor. And so they might put it on the boat for that reason. It's got that, which I don't think is any sort of official quality for yacht rock.
I'm nostalgic about hearing Beach Boys Vegetables, but I don't think that is yacht rock either.
That's so, true.
Eye in the Sky, to me, whoever, when Dave said 28, I think he may have even given it too high of a score. So,
whoa. Yeah,
I'm more of a 22 sort of guy, but I don't see that one, how it relates whatsoever, other than Alan Parsons' amazing drum sound recording. I don't think there's anything else in it, but
no.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. There's none of the R&B type jazziness, no. That's for sure. All right. Are you ready for a new lightning round feature?
Ooh, hot.
This is the lightning round within the lightning round.
Mm.
So I need you to hit the lightning round sound effect twice.
Whoa, that's overwhelming, isn't it?
So here we go. The backstory to this is you and I were recording an episode of Catch of the Day, which, if people aren't familiar with Catch of the Day, that's like a radio style show that we do. It's a 1 hour program where each time we record an episode, we pick a particular theme and we include songs related to that theme. We talk through what the theme means. And recently we did something called Novelty Yacht. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
It was kind of goofy songs. And a song came up. And by the way, if anyone out there who has a radio station or format that might want to syndicate that, that is syndicated. We're on 3 radio stations now. We're on Yacht Rock Miami. We're on Pacific Coast FM, and we are on Yacht Rock and Radio and looking for more homes. So contact us if that's something that you want to pick up. Anyways, back to the topic. One of the songs is very appropriate because it's got a big, yeah.
Yes.
So what song am I, first of all, what artist? No, I don't want you to guess, okay, because that might ruin the lightning round within the lightning
round. It
will. So you asked me while we're recording, you're like, does Paul Davis float your boat?
Right.
Typically, generally. And I, of course, said yes. I'm not so sure that that's a correct answer.
I mean, yes.
That should float my boat. But I'm going to do a lightning round. I'm going to go through the Paul Davis songs I have in my playlist.
Okay.
And give me a quick
yes or no.
Yes or no, okay, on each of them.
All right.
Would you like to start the clock?
Yes.
This aforementioned yeah song, 65 Love Affair.
No.
Cool Night.
Yes.
I Go Crazy.
Yes. Soft yes.
Soft. Well, it is a soft song.
Yeah.
And that leads us to the final, which is going to be my submission to Buried Treasure. I think it's his yachtiest tune. Do You Believe in Love?
Yes.
If you believe in love.
Very yachty.
Yes, yes, yes.
Probably
yes.
The yachtiest of all, I would think. There's others in my list, but I think that was my lightning round.
Yeah, there's probably some others. Very good, very good. Clever.
Cool. I love Paul Davis. I didn't realize how much I love Paul Davis until I got into this mess with you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Back to you for a buried treasure, sir.
Well, I have to send out props to the Rubdown for this one. This is fresh off the Rubdown. So
you're cheating because that just came out today. I know what you're
going to
do. I
know that, but I think this song was is so, I guess, you know, it came from so buried to me that I think it deserves a little extra push. So the Rubdown show looks at songs that have not yet been rated, and they score them as sort of the minor league scoring panel.
The minor leagues of smooth, as I think, as they
that's
refer
what they
to
say.
It.
Yeah, and they came up with this song. I'm just going to hit it. This is a guy named John Valenti from 1980. A song called Stephanie. So John apparently is from Chicago, I noticed. I looked up. He does have some...
The band Chicago?
No, the city.
Oh, Chicago. That would have fit perfect.
Oh, I know. but he did have some Yachty guys. So he did apparently go to California to record it. It was done at Studio Sound in North Hollywood. The album credits, I don't have a song by song. I wasn't able to find that yet. But the album does have Vinnie Caliuta on it, Ed Green, Chuck Finley. Those are mostly the names I recognize. But it's not as though this was done completely outside the bubble of our yacht rock era. So I think that they did a great job of finding that one, and I think it deserves to be known.
I jammed it.
Unburied, as you
say. Yes. I was just jammed it right before we got on, too. It's a good tune. It's amazing. We're still finding stuff from the past. You know, it's one thing to be finding new stuff, but to keep finding old stuff, that's just amazing. That's what's so cool.
Not stuff that I forgot, but stuff I had no idea. I've never heard any of this, you know, so there we go.
Maybe I steal a base here and go back to me for Off the Map, because I'll give you another example.
Okay, do it.
This is only Off the Map because I don't know how anyone would officially rate this. And this is, I'm going to go to some viewer mail. Are you ready? Viewer mail, we got written to us by a second time viewer mailer, Richard Nickel, all the way from Australia. Actually, all the way from New Zealand. I beg your pardon. That comes back.
Yeah, you might get in trouble.
I know. And he'll even reference this. I'm just going to read this to you, which will get to my submission for Off the Map. So, hello there, out of the main crew. Loved the Yachtsky-themed episode. That was cool. As your Kiwi fan here, I've been looking for New Zealand yacht, but it's hard to find. When I do, I'll share it with you guys. It'd be great to give it a cool genre name, just like Japanese yacht is city pop, waka pop. I guess a waka is a boat in the Maori language. Okay. Anyway, is
Kanga yacht?
Yes, exactly. What if Bob from Tasmania? They're like devil yacht. No. All right, I digress. Let's get back on topic. Anyway, as much as I hate to admit that Australia could have beaten New Zealand in anything, recently I picked up for $1 an album by an Australian singer, Renee Geyer, I think. It's G-E-Y-E-R. She was a bit of a bluesy singer back in the 70s and 80s, but got a deal to record an album in the States in 1977. Ding, ding. That's right in the heart of it. It was called Moving Along. It's definitely a tip of the hat to the yacht sound and has Ray Parker on guitar.
Ooh.
So it's got personnel. I'm thinking it's Yachty. Anyway, that's me saying. He's the only personnel of note. The pick of the tracks for me is Be There in the Morning. So, Richard sums up. He says it's a smooth track. I'm not sure if it's yacht, but it's a great tune. So, anyways, that's a great submission. And since we don't know exactly how any of us would rule, to me, it's a little disco-y, I think.
Yep, I did hear some disco elements in that. Yep, but it's definitely emblematic of the era, so I like that.
Here's to prove that Richard is, in fact, a listener. He said, P.S., well, I know you hate P.S.s.
Yeah.
Because you referenced that in one of the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But nice. He did give me permission to read his name and his country in the podcast. So thanks a lot, Richard. Keep them coming. And everyone else as well. Well, get us out of here. What do you got in the final lightning round?
Final off-the-map submission here is from 1992. Sonically, it is outside of the... obviously, time frame, it's outside of the era. But sonically, also, it's getting into a little more Drum Machine 90s sound, of course, but from an arrangement perspective, the arrangement of the parts and the is spot on. And this is a cool cover by Go West. Remember Go West?
Oh, yeah. They have something that's Yachty?
Or Bobby Caldwell's What You Won't Do for Love.
Oh my God.
How do you like that?
What a great cover. What a great find for off the bat. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I've got one that's almost as good, but I got to hold it for next time. But yes. That's what we call a cliffhanger. Ooh. All right. Well, speaking of cliffhangers, we've broken this episode into two parts, which means we're going to take a week-long break, get back to Tris next week. We're going to actually dive into the Chicago years next. And until then, what do you want to say there, Captain?
Have you come up with any other new ways of leaving a hanging cliff other than...
Well, there's Cliff Richard, but...
And then there, okay.
Why? Do you have something?
I just have ahoy.